will call this meeting of the Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee to order. First on our agenda for the day, members, we have approval of yesterday's minutes. I was going to have our resident Irishman approve the minutes for St. Patrick's Day, but he has stepped away for a moment. Representative Coulter, would you care to move approval of yesterday's minutes?
I will make that motion, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Coulter moves approval of the minutes from Tuesday, March 17th. Any discussion to that motion, members? Any questions or changes to the minutes? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor of approval, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes from Tuesday, March 17th are approved. First on the first bill up for today, members, is House File 3665 from Chair Pinto. Welcome back to the Children and Families Committee, Chair Pinto. I will move your bill. To the general register. So if you would like to go ahead and explain your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and Chair West and members. It's a pleasure to be back with you. I missed the Children and Families Committee, I've been sorry to have a schedule conflict and not be able to be with you this session, but I'm glad to be with you today. House File 3665 is a bill that came actually out of a course that I had taught at the Humphrey School of the University of Minnesota. Sitting next to me is a student who was in that course. I should say I'm not currently teaching the class. We're all done. But an idea that came out of that related out-of-home placement plans, which appropriately provide for educational stability for children in K-12 learning, but do not address learning for children under the age of five. And so Danny Thomas, the student sitting next to me, identified that, noticed that, and thought that it would make sense to close that gap and provide for stability as well for younger kids. I will note, Madam Chair, there is an A1 amendment that came partly at the suggestion of DCYF. I might ask if there's staff who can help just describe the change in the amendment. And I know that there's there's just a typo that came in the amendment as well that we were hoping to get fixed.
Okay, very good, Chair Pinto. First, actually, I guess I'm going to change my motion. Looks like members were going to lay over this bill pending a fiscal note. So, and then Ms. Sunderman, if you would be able to walk us through the A1 amendment, and then I will... Well, I guess I'll move the A1 amendment. Ms. Sunderman can speak to it, and then I can move the oral amendment as we go forward.
Madam Chair and members, the A1 amendment replaces Section 2 of the bill with essentially the same language coded in a different section, as suggested by, I believe, the department. It also modifies slightly... if you look at the original bill, lines 7.17 to 17.20, it only requires the responsible social services agency to provide this information rather than a licensed child placing agency or the child's guardian ad litem. And the oral amendment, if you'd like me to
certainly you can
that.
Yeah, give us an update on that oral amendment.
Yes, the oral amendment just changes the coding, so it would be the amendment to the A1 amendment would be page 1, line 3, delete 260C.515 and insert 260C.215.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Sunderman. Members, I will go ahead and move the oral amendment to the A1, and we will first vote on that. Is there any member discussion or questions to the oral amendment to the A1 amendment? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor of the oral amendment to the A1, please say aye. Aye. Any opposed? All right. Motion prevails, and the oral amendment to the A1 is adopted. So do we wish to discuss further the A1 amendment as adopted, Chair Pinto? Okay, very good. So, members, I will move the... We will vote on the A1 as amended to House File 3665. Any member discussion or questions to that motion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Right. The A1 amendment as adopted. as amended, is adopted. And now, Chair Pinto, to House File 3665 as amended. And it looks like you have a testifier joining you. So if you'd introduce yourself for the record, and then please proceed.
Hello, Chairs. I am happy to be here. My name is Danny Thomas. I am a second-year MPA student. I also want to share that as a teenager, I was in the foster care system and later became a kinship guardian for my little sister in my home state of West Virginia. This bill grew out of a semester-long research project I conducted on the intersection of Minnesota's child welfare and early learning systems. During that research, I came across a report that was commissioned by the Minnesota Legislature on early care and education participation among children in foster care. The report, which was published by the Center for Advanced Studies in Child Welfare, found that foster children participate in early care and education at significantly lower rates than children statewide. I would like to point out that the study's authors also noted that enrollment is likely overestimated because of limitations in how data is reported in Minnesota's early childhood longitudinal data system. This bill ensures that crucial services and information are consistently provided to foster families. One of the barriers identified in the study was a lack of information about available childcare and childcare assistance. This finding matches what I have heard in informational interviews since last September. I have spoken with social services workers, child advocates, researchers, and former fosters who have stated that many foster families simply do not know how to access childcare or navigate the available assistance programs. This bill proposes a simple but important update, ensuring that out-of-home placement plans address educational stability, not only for children in K through 12, but also for young children in early learning environments. Currently, state statute focuses only on school-aged children, leaving early education out of these plans. This update is especially important given that as of this year, DCYF reports that 65% of the days children spend in foster care are with relatives. Until 2023, kinship caregivers were not eligible for most child care assistance programs, including CCAP. Even though they now qualify, many may not know that support is available to them. I will end with this. My sister and I were fortunate to attend daycare before entering public school. The relationships we built with those early childhood educators still matter to us today. My sister now sends her two children to the same center. For us, it was more than daycare. It was a place where we experienced stability, safety, and care during a very difficult time in our lives. And for a young child in foster care, I can't imagine anything more important. Thank you for your time and your consideration.
Thank you so much, Ms. Thomas, for your testimony and sharing your story with us today. Are there any members of the audience who wish to testify on House File 3665? Right. Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions. Chair West.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Pinto. Thanks for bringing this bill. I'm just looking at the Minnesota Association of County Social Administrators has a letter here. And I'm actually genuinely interested here, not trying to gotcha or anything.
Yeah.
Three paragraphs down, many county communities across Minnesota experience child care shortages that make this difficult, possibly possible to achieve. The county would be responsible for documenting compliance when services are unavailable. Is there anything you can add to assuage the concerns that were listed right there?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair West. I think it's important, especially for the Children and Families Committee, to situate this particular proposal in the broader context that it is true that we invest 10 times as much once a child turns 5 for care and learning than we do under 5, and we know that we've got unaffordable and often inaccessible early care and learning as compared to older care and learning. And so I recognize that social service agencies, on top of dealing with child welfare challenges, that they then would have to deal with that challenge as well. I guess what I'd say is that I believe that built into 260C.212 right now is the concept that the county should strive for stability for the child in their learning and care. And that, you know, if that's not possible, that sort of there's realistic constraints that occur for kids in K-12, and there's also realistic constraints that occur for 0 to 5. Those constraints are greater for 0 to 5. I hope that we can be addressing those in other policy ways. But I would not expect that there'd be the same standard that would apply, sort of treating early care and learning as if there's as much availability as if for K-12. But we do have to, there do have to be sort of equivalent efforts made to just recognize the importance of early care and learning as compared to later care and learning. That'd be my basic response. Maybe the Ms. Thomas, having talked to a number of groups, may have another thought as well, Madam Chair.
Ms. Thomas?
No, I think you stated it extremely well. Thank you.
Follow-up, Chair West?
Thank you, Madam Chair. But one more question, not a follow-up on that. So how do you envision this working in emergency placement situations where decisions have to be made very quickly?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah. So a basic principle, Chair West, that I would say with this bill, and again, I'd really urge you all to consider this in every setting, is how do we do it with the other kids? So the question is, if there's an emergency setting with a child in first grade or second grade, what happens then? And then consider a child who's 7 or 8, and then, well, how does that work for 3 or 4? So it would be the same mechanism that happens with those older kids. It may be that Ms. Sunderman or somebody else can guide us for how that works with older kids, but in general, I really want to push that principle of not distinguishing among age unless we really have to.
Ms. Sunderman, do you have any relevant information?
Oh, it looks like Ms. Thomas may have something to add as well. Chair, could you switch tune, too?
Ms. Thomas, go right ahead.
Thank you. So as I understand it, the out-of-home placement plans aren't required to actually be finalized until 30 days after the child is placed out of the home. So I can't speak to emergency placements specifically, but with regards to changing the requirements in OHPPs, it wouldn't have to happen immediately. Yeah.
Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to comment a little bit about how I understand that this works in the school system. So, because I know that this is has become kind of a large line item in Minneapolis and the district I represent. So, there is a lot of like individual rides or taxi kind of services that are used for students to get them from, you know, where they are currently living to the school that they had been a part of. You know, that is an effort to create stability for that student. I think recognizing that the, like, school can be a stable community so that even if their home has changed, they should still be able to access those services. And they are not inexpensive. I mean, it has kind of become a major cost within Minneapolis. So I think it's something to consider when thinking about this. But I have also, you know, heard from individuals that it's been incredibly meaningful and important to them to be able to stay connected to their school community. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sensenmura, for your service on the K-12 committee as well. I don't have any other members on the list. Did I miss anyone? Okay. I want to express my support for the contents of the bill. I think, you know, as a former foster parent to early childhood age children, I know just how important that continuity of care is. And I think, you know, to some degree, we all experience that whether we are raising biological children or we are supporting someone else's children for a period of time when they're in and out of our home. And even the disruption of the industry that we see with people kind of coming in and out of working as a child care provider, simply given sometimes the hourly rates, the hourly wages. And so I know that when our daughter was in her 2-year-old care room, it felt like, unfortunately, there was a new teacher every month. And it's really hard for them to build those relationships and gain trust. And that's something that I think we should take every effort to do, particularly when they are experiencing disruption of placement and potentially separation from their biological families. So appreciate you bringing this before us, Chair Pinto. Members, I will renew my motion to lay over House File 3665 as amended, and we will await the fiscal note. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, members. Thank you, chairs and members.
The bill is laid over. Next on the agenda, members, we have House File 3002 from our very own Representative Hicks. The motion, and Representative Hicks will move House File
laid over.
3002 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Hicks, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Chair and members, for hearing this bill. I have something prepared to share with you, but before I do, about the details of the bill, I have an amendment.
So, Representative Hicks, you do have a DE2 author's amendment. If you would give us a little bit of detail about the amendment, or would you prefer to move it as an author's amendment and discuss the bill as amended?
I'll move it as an author's amendment and discuss the bill as amended. I will just say, I take that back. I will just say that this was pared down significantly from what I would like to do. And that is in an attempt to reduce cost. I'd like to talk a little bit more about that, maybe during member discussion.
Right, absolutely. So, members, Representative Hicks moves the DE2 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that she would like. Any discussion or questions to the author's amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Any opposed? All right. The motion prevails, and the DE2 amendment is adopted. So, Representative Hicks, go right ahead and tell us about your bill as amended.
Yes. So, this bill is amended to make improvements to youth with transference of permanent legal custody and improvements for all children eligible for extended foster care, including some minor technical things, but also will require that children in foster care who are 14 and older have an independent living plan to support planning and consideration with the young person and their future, allow young people who are eligible for disability supports to choose to remain in extended foster care if they prefer, clarifies that extended school time as part of a disability is in alignment with school for qualifying extended foster care, allows youth who've gained a temporary TPLC as their permanency option within 6 months of turning 18 to be eligible for foster care supports, and adds additional accountability requiring that when a young person is terminated from foster care, that DCYF commissioner also receive that notification. These provisions will support young people as they transition into adulthood. Please also note that there's a report in your packets from the office, I never can say that word, ombudsperson for foster care youth. I would really love for you all to read that report. I think it really highlights where we have some holes in our system that we desperately need to close. This permanency option requires additional work from this body. And I really hope that we can have that conversation. I have limited testifiers today because a bunch of them got stuck in the weather. But I would like to tell you a story about one section of the bill. So I'd like to direct you all to line 2.2 on the amendment, 2.20. And it is striking language that allows counties to deny extended foster care just because a child has a disability. So as you all know, I'm a foster parent, and I know lots of other foster parents, and I'm very active in our community. And in the interim, a young woman who I adore dearly, who has a disability, came up to me in community and was crying. And I said, "What is wrong?" And she said, "Who's going to throw my graduation party?" And I said, "What in the world are you talking about? My worker told me I have to move into a group home when I turn 18. She's 16. And I said, "You don't have to move into a group home when you turn 16. You can stay with your foster family till you graduate from high school." "No," they said, "I can't because I'm not going to be able to live on my own. I have to move into a group home." "So that's not true, sweetie. You can stay with your family, the foster family she's been living with for several years." And then she said, "That's what they told me." And I said, "Okay." So, and she said, "Who do you think will take me prom dress shopping if I don't have a mom?" And I said, "Well," her foster mom, "will always take you places. She loves you deeply. But I want her to take me prom dress shopping. I want her to throw my graduation party. this young woman is going to be in an 18 to 21 program because she has a disability. And she was told she had to move. She had to leave the family that she'd been with for no other reason than she had to be put into a group home with other people with disabilities. The foster family is willing to keep her. There's no concerns about that. And the statute that they pointed to as the reason is 2.2. I would like to strike 2.2 so that no child with a disability is ever forced out of a family situation because they might need additional supports as a person with a disability. You can get disability supports in extended foster care. You can be a person with a disability and remain in family. You are not required, because the commissioner is your guardian, to enter into a group home. You have a voice as a youth. Everything in this bill gives that voice. An independent living plan, a voice in that conversation, the ability to stay in family if you're in an 18 to 21 program. Just because sometimes things are hard for the adults to do doesn't mean we shouldn't do them. I would like to turn it over to my testifiers.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hicks. If you would, if you want to maybe get the microphone perhaps a little bit closer there, Representative Hicks. And then when you're ready, you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Kwame.
Thank you for joining us. You can continue with your testimony.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, co-chairs, committee members, for having me today. My name is Kwame. I spent most of my childhood in and out of foster care starting at the age of 7. I aged out of foster care as a ward of the state in 2020. In my last year of foster care, I bounced it around many different places, including group homes, youth shelters, and lastly, St. Cloud Juvenile Detention Center. I wasn't allowed to leave St. Cloud until I aged out at 18. I experienced all these placements even though my uncle's home was available, and I eventually went to live with him after I turned 18. As I reached 18, my worker explained the extended foster care program to me. My uncle will receive a stipend check and give me a portion of it, but I never received any of my stipend while I was in living there with him. Shortly after I turned 19, actually, while I was still finishing high school, my AOC worker told me I wasn't staying with my uncle anymore. This made me homeless until they eventually home me with someone who was looking to become a foster parent. After a not so long period of time, he decided to not foster me anymore, and I was once again homeless, but I wasn't supported as much in finding another place to live. I stayed in a lot of different places after this. I mostly stayed outside, sleeping under bridges, parks, abandoned homes, and buildings, and occasionally with friends. This was all at the height of COVID, when I was supposed to be finishing high school virtually, but I struggled to stay connected. I never heard from my worker during this time. When I was 19, I reconnected with school, and eventually my worker told me about a new housing resource that has some units specifically for youth who were in EFC and experienced homelessness. I moved in. And with this newfound stability, I was able to engage at school and started to receive my EFC checks for the first time, but my health was starting to greatly decline. I knew I had diabetes, I found out in 2019, but I was medically neglected throughout my time in foster care, so I never learned how to manage my care. My group homes and the St. Cloud placement knew I had diabetes, but offered little help. It wasn't being properly prioritized. I remember taking other medications at St. Cloud and the other group homes, but rarely, if ever, they tested my blood sugars or gave me insulin. It never really talked to me about managing my diabetes. After years of medical neglect, I was starting to lose my sight, weight, teeth, and many other things. This made it really hard to stay engaged in class. I was showing up, but I couldn't see the board or a lot of the work that was that we were working on. I was spending a lot of my days at school in the staff offices getting one-on-one help. And if not that, I'll just go to class, get my work, and go off somewhere and work. But this meant I was technically absent from class. My AFC worker said I wasn't going to school enough to get my stipend. They said I could split my required hours between work and school, so I started working. I was going to school during the day and working 4 p.m. to 2 a.m. most days to stay eligible. I wasn't getting help with transportation, so I had to take the bus to work and school, navigating a complex bus schedule across cities while losing my sight was not easy, but I was doing it. I managed to get my attendance at school back in good standings. I sent this to my EFC worker, hoping this would requalify me as I was told to receive my checks, but they said I needed to show one more month of good attendance, then I would get my checks, in which I did, and I was also able to stay in school and later graduate. But long after this, not too long after this, but I never got an EFC check again in that whole time. I'm still not clear on why. I was told that it was being said that I was, in fact, never in foster care. I heard that the 6 months prior to my 18th birthday weren't consecutive in foster care, I wasn't eligible. I am now considered legally and medically blind, with about 20% of my sight remaining, is what I feel. I've been denied Social Security multiple times. I don't have insurance because I'm not eligible for MA for foster youth. I've had to put off cataract surgery and other necessary care about that could seriously improve my life. I've heard from other fosters who had much different experiences in EFC. One person I talked to said she just had to attend her therapy appointments and this qualified her. Another person was working with YouthLink on their personal goals and this qualified them. These are both things that I was doing all while finishing high school and going blind, but I still got kicked out. The EFC rules allows workers to pick and choose who stays in EFC and who doesn't. Nothing is uniform. I can only imagine how different my life would be now if I had been financially, emotionally, and physically supported during this time transitioning out. I hope that somehow I could get that funding that was supposed to help while I was aging out. And I hope that using my voice will help create a better system for foster youth that came after me, especially those who are navigating complex medical care and disability. This bill is an important step for youth like me. Thank you, Senator Port and Representative Hicks, for bringing attention to these issues.
Kwame, thank you for joining us today and for sharing your story. And I'm so sorry for the difficulties that you faced throughout the past few years. Representative Hicks, we have Mimi Chapman listed as a testifier as well. Okay,
she's ill.
Okay. She's not going to be able to join us today. All right. Is there anyone else present who would like to testify on House File 3002? All right. Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions.
Chair, can I just direct people to the packets?
Certainly. Representative Hicks.
The packets have support letters from various organizations in them as well. I would like to add, we have requested a fiscal. I would like to go on the record indicating that I don't believe there should be a fiscal because the language that's in here around, specifically around Medicaid. So to be clear, I'm talking about Medicaid. It says receiving foster care benefits past the age of 18. Because many people with disabilities that are the folks that striking in 2.2 are they're looking at additional supports as the reason for striking. They already have medical assistance as people with disabilities. So I just want to sort of say on the record that I attempted to pare this down so there would not be a significant fiscal impact, but there's a little bit of a discussion about that still occurring. So just sort of wanted to highlight that for folks in case there were questions around that piece.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. I don't have any members on the list. So with that, Representative Hicks will renew her motion to lay over House File 3002. The bill is laid over. I have a guest gavel tapper today. So next on the list, members, we have
Chair,
House...
Chair Katiza Watun, if you wouldn't mind introducing your guest gavel before we proceed.
Mm. Do you want to say hi in the microphone? Okay. My youngest son is joining us today. So. His name is Lachlan. It's Scottish, not Irish, though. It's the Scottish spelling. Representative McDonald. All right. Next on the agenda, we have House File 4125 from Representative Egbaje. Representative Egbaje, welcome to the committee. And since you are a guest here in Children and Families, I will move House File 4125 before the committee today and move to re-refer to the Committee on Judiciary and Civil Law. It's my understanding that you have an amendment.
Yes.
To the bill. All right. So, members, I will first move the A4 author's amendment. And Representative Egbaje, can you go ahead and tell us a little bit about the A4?
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. The amendment before you puts the bill in the shape that I would like it, and I will go ahead and describe it briefly. The amendment addresses the definition of disproportionately represented child. It clarifies that the commissioner must make a determination of which communities are overrepresented in child protection cases, and this determination will be done every 2 years. Similarly, the commissioner must also define a child with disability or low socioeconomic status. These definitions must be based on objective data, such as state and U.S. census data about families, and the commissioner then must also show how they made that determination. The amendment also addresses case reviews. Counties say that they are unable to take on the role of case reviews, so this amendment proposes phasing this over time to move it to the agency DCYF. The reports stay at the same timeline as in the original statute, and while the case reviews are transitioning to the agency. The amendment also narrows the scope of these cases to only child protection cases rather than a wide range of child welfare cases. The underlying bill, when we get to it, also includes an open appropriation to enable us to negotiate for the amount of resources that we can give to counties to implement the law in 2027. In addition, the amendment cleans up some cross-references throughout and adds guardian ad litem to more training opportunities. I understand that there's probably a number of testifiers, so once we put the amendment on, I'm happy to go straight to the testifiers.
All right. Thank you, Representative Egbaje. Members, we're going to vote on the A4 author's amendment. Are there any discussion or questions to the A4? And then we can continue to discuss the bill as amended. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the A4 amendment is adopted. Now on to House File 4125 as amended. Representative Egbaje already gave us a little bit of an overview there, and you would like to move on to testifiers, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So first on the list, we have Commissioner Rena Moran, former Representative Moran. You can come up to the testifiers table when you're ready, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed. And then she will be followed by Kaylees Houston.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Contenza Watun and Chair West, and members of the committee. I want to thank you for the opportunity. How are we doing? To testify. It's good to be in front of this committee and the work that you do to keep children and families safe and thriving and all the work in between that. So thank you for your work and your leadership. My name is Rena Moran, and I have the honor of serving as a Ramsey County Commissioner for District 4. representing the Hamlin Midway, Frogtown, Summit University, North End, Downtown, Summit Hill, McAllister, Groveland, and Highland Park, and the Capitol 2 is within my district. As a former member of this body, I focus on protecting children in the child welfare system and promoting early childhood policies. I also was a part of helping to develop this bill and also carry this bill as a former legislator. And so I know the work of just how important it is to move from reasonable effort to an active effort, as we just heard from the former testifier here. Now, in my role at the county level, I am responsible for implementing it. I like to say that counties are often the ones who make the legislature's dreams come true. And I say that because as a former legislator, we had the work and the obligation to create the policies and put the dollars to those policies across the state. And then you let this work go out into the world, into the universe, into counties and cities across the state. And it is within the counties that we do this work, to work to ensure that what you have put in front of us has been done appropriately. So we have the work of making your dreams come true. At Ramsey County, I've seen firsthand both the potential of this work and what it truly makes and what it truly takes to make it succeed. I want to highlight three key implementation considerations as you consider House File 4125. First, we strongly support the proposal to transfer case reviews responsibilities to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Moving case reviews to the state agency is consistent with how case reviews operates in other programs. Ramsey County has already invested significant resources in this area, but the administrative burden and the financial costs are unsustainable for counties. Second, we support the appropriation of funding for all counties to implement this legislation. As an early implementer, Ramsey County has been developing the infrastructure, workforce, and community partnership needed to make these dreams come true. The investments have been significant. The acts require counties to fundamentally change how they approach this work. It calls for new staffing models, specialized training, increased engagement with families and community providers, and much more comprehensive data collection and reporting. These are system-level changes. Funding for this work is essential and is needed. Third and finally, the 2024 legislation provided $2.5 million to Ramsey County and Hennepin counties to help fund a two-year implementation phase. The funding is available until June the 30th of 2026, 6 months before the end of the implementation phase. So Ramsey County support extending this appropriation until December the 31st of 2026 to align with the full implementation phase where their work is actively ongoing. I want to thank Representative Abaje for authoring this bill, for leading this bill, and for taking the time to meet with county and to hear our concerns. It makes a difference. And thanks to the committee for hearing this bill. And I am happy to answer any questions if need be.
Thank you, Commissioner. We will ask any questions as when we get to member discussion later on. Thank you so much for joining us. Next, we have Kelis Houston, who will be followed by Joanna Woolman. If you'd come up to the testifiers table. And Ms. Houston, you can introduce yourself and proceed when you're ready. Both of you can come up to the table since we have got two chairs, and then we'll just kind of keep going on. Can introduce yourself when you're ready.
Oh, sorry, Kelis Houston, I'm here on behalf of Village Arms and the NAACP Minneapolis. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on HF 4125 and to speak to what is at stake for African American and other disproportionately represented families in Minnesota. I want to begin by grounding us in truth. The disproportionate removal of Black children from their families did not begin with modern policy. It is part of a continuous history of state-sanctioned family separation that dates back over 400 years. During slavery, Black children were taken, sold, and separated from their parents as a matter of law and economic practice. Black mothers were denied the right to care for and even nurse their own babies, forced instead to nurse and nurture the children of others while their own families were neglected or torn apart. Speaking out against this system came with brutal consequences. Enslaved people who resisted were beaten, maimed, or killed to enforce silence and control. And that legacy did not end. It has evolved. Today, we see its continuation in a child welfare system where Black families are still disproportionately surveilled, separated, and denied the right to raise their own children. And just as in the past, we're told to wait for reform, wait for accountability, and wait for justice. But we've been waiting over 400 years. We cannot continue to accept delay when the harm is ongoing and the patterns are so clearly rooted in this history. In Minnesota, Black children are removed from their homes at rates far exceeding their representation in the population. For our community, it has been a continuation of a long legacy of state-sanctioned family separation. Our community has been fighting this issue for over 50 years, and that doesn't even include the 7 years we fought to pass the African American Family Preservation Act. So to now be told that we must wait an additional 5 years for meaningful accountability is not just frustrating, it's an insult. Every single day we wait, another child is harmed, another family is disrupted, another bond between a child and their parents, grandparents, and kin is broken, more often than not, unnecessarily. The research is clear. Family preservation is in the best interest of children, and removal is one of the most harmful interventions we can impose. HF 4125 must not weaken the very protections that AFPA was designed to create. First, the proposed delay of case review reporting until 2031 is completely unacceptable. Case reviews, are the central accountability mechanism of this law. They are how we identify patterns of unnecessary removals, failures in safety planning, and the underuse of kinship care. Delaying them allows harm to continue unchecked. These reviews must commence no later than 2029 as mandated and must include 100% of African American children in every county so that we can identify disparities and correct them in real time. Second, every case review must include all African American children. This law was created specifically to address disparities impacting Black children, the group most harmed by this system. Moving to a tiered or sample-based approach that includes other populations will dilute the focus and make it impossible to measure whether the law is working. Anything less than a full review is a failure of accountability. The state has both a legal and ethical responsibility to act with urgency. Thousands of Black children continue to experience unnecessary removals, prolonged foster care placements, and the disruption of family and community ties. You heard from the young man that testified prior his experience with the foster care system. That is what led me into this work, serving at St. Joseph's Home for Children, watching the system chew children up and spit them out just as he described is what led me to want to have a voice in the courtroom. I've served in child protection court as a guardian ad litem in two counties with egregious disparities and poor outcomes for Black families. I can tell you that they're using a lot of the state's money on a system that does not work for those that it's designed to serve. What we're asking you for and what we continue to ask for is that you take the cries of those involved and on the ground with families serious and make the changes and adjustments that we're asking for. We've already demonstrated that this works in practice, and we did this without additional funding from the legislature, although I support funding from the legislature. Over a three-year pilot of the African American Family Preservation Act in Hennepin County, we served more than 200 families, and we closed over 90% of our cases without ever removing a single child from their home. In the small number of cases where removal was necessary, 100% of those children were placed with kin. and these outcomes were the direct result of applying active efforts from the beginning of a case. These results also translate into significant cost savings for the state. Child removal is among the most expensive intervention in the child welfare system, and I believe the average cost is like $20,000 per child per their six-month stay in foster care. By safely preventing removal in over 90% of the cases, this model avoided those costs entirely. Even in the cases where removal was necessary, prioritizing kinship placements reduced reliance on higher-cost foster care settings and kept resources within families rather than the system. When you consider the long-term fiscal impact, including reduced court involvement, fewer placement disruptions, and better stability for children, the savings to the state are substantial. And I'll just end with this. The success of that pilot made one thing clear. This bill is not about creating a new system or requiring new appropriations. It's about codifying a shift in practice, one that prioritizes active efforts, family engagement, and culturally grounded decision making. The outcomes we achieved, both in human impact and cost savings, show that meaningful change is possible when we change how we work. And that is what AFPA is about, a policy and practice shift. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We next have Joanna Woolman, who will be followed by Commissioner Irene Fernando. You can come up to the testifiers table, Commissioner. I do just want to acknowledge that we have a number of folks who may be new to participating in a committee at the legislature and want to confirm that I, as the committee chair, will maintain control of the rest of these proceedings and establish the following expectations. Signs and placards are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause or other audible demonstrations are not allowed. For safety reasons, standing or sitting in walkways or aisles, or standing or obstructing at your chair is prohibited. If you require any accommodation, please speak with our sergeant staff. It's identified by gold ties. Troopers and house security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety, and failure to comply with these guidelines may result in the removal from the hearing room. Our goal is to conduct the rest of these proceedings efficiently while ensuring everyone the opportunity to observe and participate appropriately. Thank you for that. And Ms. Woolman, if you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Nice to see you. My name is Joanna Woolman, and I'm an attorney and the executive director of a nonprofit in Minnesota called Keeping Families Connected Minnesota. I've been a practicing attorney in the child welfare space in Minnesota for almost 25 years, primarily representing parents and relatives in child welfare cases. I'm here today to offer some brief comments about the amendments that Representative Ogbaje has introduced today to this critical piece of legislation that was passed last year. As a practitioner and a lawyer, I understand and know very well what adding or tinkering with language in a statute can do to actual practice. Every word that is changed or added is really critical and has to be carefully evaluated to understand or anticipate any unintended consequences. The amendments proposed in this bill make sense and address concerns that have been discussed and lifted up as the process of implementation of this bill has moved forward. The definitions included in it are critical for our understanding of the families that will be included under this act, and the clarity provided in those definitions is needed on the ground to make a decision at the time about who comes within the scope of this legislation. Additionally, the process laid out to transfer cases from county to state sort of control for the review process is another critical step in understanding how this is going to work. That process also is critical to the partnership that this bill made with communities about accountability and practice change. And so I think that those amendments are also really critical. Finally, and perhaps even though it's the smallest, the recognition of confusion between the word child welfare and child protection is an essential and necessary change that is needed going forward. It's been very confusing for counties to understand the scope of cases that come within this act, and the simple change of those words provides a ton of clarity for practitioners on the ground. I'm not someone who works for a county or a state agency, but I can say as an attorney that these amendments make sense and they are needed to improve practice and make the bill work. That's all I have for today. I would also like to ask if it's possible, I'm not on the list to be
a responder or to comment on the amendment proposed by Representative Nelson as well.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Next, we have Commissioner Irene Fernando. If you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Irene Fernando, Hennepin County Board Chair, and I use she, her pronouns. Thank you for the opportunity to, in support of House File 4125. In 2024, with very strong bipartisan support, lawmakers passed the Minnesota African American Family Preservation and Child Welfare Disproportionality Act, also known as MAFPA. Lawmakers showed a shared commitment to address the significant disparities in the state's child protection system, such as data showing that African American children in Minnesota are removed from their homes at rates 3 to 5 times higher than their white counterparts, 3 to 5 times higher. MAFPA is designed to promote family stability, family reunification, and more positive outcomes for all children who are disproportionately represented in the child protection system. Hennepin is proud to be one of two counties who are phasing in MAFPA. Starting in January of 2025, we began our work to apply active efforts to a subset of families in the child protection system. So far, these results have been incredibly promising. For example, as of February 2026, only 3.8% of MAFPA phase-in cases in Hennepin have experienced out-of-home placement. Only 3.8%, a significantly lower rate than prior to MAFPA implementation for children disproportionately represented in the child protection system. Hennepin County strongly supports two key provisions of this bill, county resources and state-level case review. First, applying the active effort standard of MAFPA requires more resources. Increased staffing is needed to reduce caseload size and invest in more intensive relationship-based work. MAFPA also means counties providing more access to concrete supports for families, such as housing assistance, transportation, childcare, and other basic needs. We strongly support the resources that the bill invests in counties to help offset these expenses. Second, this bill also shifts case review to the state level. Case review at the state level ensures greater efficiency, consistency, and cost effectiveness instead of requiring each of the 87 counties to conduct case reviews. We also appreciate the technical change to align the resources for the phase-in with the actual phase-in timeline. House File 4125 will bolster the ability for counties to successfully implement MAFPA in 2027. Thank you, Representative Bajaj, for your leadership on MAFPA overall and your authorship. Thank you to county staff and community providers who work with our children and families every single day, noting that Hennepin staff are present for any program-specific questions later on. And, of course, thank you, Madam Chair, and to the committee.
Thank you for joining us and for sharing Hennepin's part in this process. All right, we have a few remaining testifiers on the list. The initial four testifiers were a part of Representative Igbaje's presentation, and the remaining testifiers will have 2 minutes to testify. First, we have Tina Schenk, who is joining us from Meeker County, will be followed by Kirsten Langerman, also from Meeker County. Okay. Once you're situated, you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and committee members, for allowing us the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Tina Schenk. I am the director at Meeker County Health and Human Services, and I have with me Kirsten Langerman, who is our child protection supervisor. We'd like to tell you our Meeker County story. In 2019, Meeker County had 3 child protection workers and 68 children in out-of-home placement. For reference, our county is about 24,000 people. Our county board recognized we needed systemic change and committed significant resources to support that change through the hiring of 3 additional child protection staff. Over the next 2 years, we worked with a child welfare consultation company to transform the way that we work with families. We adopted the value that families have the fundamental right to remain together. We improved our work by setting clear safety goals, centering families as the experts, and implementing family safety network planning, and shifting our mindset towards true partnership, where a family's voice drives the change needed. We learned that families often need resources, not separation, and we began to see results. By 2025, we had 9 children in placement, an 87% decrease from 2019.
We recognize that no system is perfect, and we continue to recognize the areas where we need to continue to grow. Despite our movements towards active efforts with our families and the outcomes that we've already achieved, implementation of MAPFA CWCDA would require Meeker County to invest financial resources. However, unlike in 2019, the landscape Meeker County is facing is very different, resulting from implementing federal policy changes, the tightened workforce environment, and other factors placing strain on our local tax levy. Today, we are here to seek your support for the appropriation of funding for staff and services needed for the implementation of MAPFA CWDA and the continued growth. And we ask for the state to complete the case reporting requirements under the Act so we can remain grounded in the work with our families. With your help, we can implement MAPFA CWDA in a way that doesn't just check boxes, but brings the full intent and vision of the Act to fruition, strengthening the support of our families and creating lasting safety. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Langerman, can I ask you to introduce yourself for the record, although your colleague introduced you as well?
Kirsten Langerman, Meeker County Health and Human Services.
Thank you so much for your testimony. All right. Next, we have Chad and Katia Thompson, who are participating via Zoom. If you could unmute yourself and introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chad Thompson. My wife, Koch, and I are licensed foster parents in Candiota County. We live in New London, Minnesota, with our 9-year-old daughter, who was also adopted through foster care. We are here today to share our family story because of what happened with us should not happen to another child. In April of 2022, we received a phone call from Candiota County Family Services asking if we would take placement of a baby boy who would be born in June of 2022. We were told this would be an expedited termination through and straight to adoption, and there were no safe relative options, and that parental rights would be terminated. We said yes after careful thought and consideration. We prepared for him like any parents would. We set up a nursery, bought everything he needed, and chose a name that we would give him when adoption was finalized. He was born June 10th, 2022. My wife held him when he was just 6 hours old, and two days later, he came home with us, where he lived for 3 years and 1 day. From the moment he entered our home, we were his parents in every capacity. Shortly after he was born, we were informed that the biological parents were seeking custody. On February 14th, 2024, their rights were terminated. Their parental rights had already been involuntarily terminated for 3 other children due to severe abuse. All 3 of those siblings have since been adopted by a safe, loving family in a nearby community whom we've had constant contact since the little boy was born. Then 6 months later, a relative uncle came forward, the biological mother's brother. This individual had previously been overlooked as a placement option due to serious allegations, including sexual abuse claims made by the biological mother, his own sister. He was also other than honorable discharged from the Marine Corps and refused to disclose the details of his discharge during trial. These concerns just didn't disappear, but despite that, he was later licensed through a third-party agency, Ampersand, who also paid for his legal fees throughout this process. For over 2.5 years, Chippewa County consistently argued that it was in our foster boy's best interest to remain with us, the only family he'd ever known. They raised concerns about the uncle. They supported adoption with our family. They signed an adoption placement agreement with us. But what happened next is where our system has failed this child. That adoption and placement agreement was denied by Minnesota Department of Human Services, now it's DCYF, specifically Kathleen Hinneker. In our case, DCYF did not just review the district court decision, they overrode it. Despite over 2 years of the county stating that it was in our foster son's best interest to remain with us, DCYF instructed the county to pursue relative placement instead. The impact of that directive was immediate. The county changed its position, not because new evidence was presented, not because safety concerns were resolved, but because DCYF would not approve an adoption with our family. the same county, the same facts, the same child. But a completely different recommendation. In court, DCYF Representative Kathleen Hinneker testified that they would not approve an adoption placement agreement with us under any circumstances. Even if it was court ordered, she said she would contact the Attorney General for an appeal. At that point, the outcome was no longer about the child's best interest. It was about compliance with DCYF. The judge ultimately ruled that our foster son should be placed with the relative, stating it was a very difficult decision, but one he believed the law required. The day after his third birthday, he was...
Yes. If you could just wrap up your testimony, we're at 4 minutes. I appreciate you sharing your story.
Madam Chair, you gave everyone else no time limits whatsoever. I think it's bad form to cut off another testifier.
Representative Olson?
I'm almost done.
There are four testifiers who are part of Representative Egbaje's presentation. I did list out a two-minute time limit. He's gone over 2 minutes. I appreciate them sharing their story. You can wrap up in the next 15 seconds, please.
I guess I'll skip to the end. We're not against relative placement. We got an update on March 12th from Chippewa County, from the Family Services. The child continues to thrive in his current relative foster home. The next sentence is, he recently has more struggles with emotional regulation almost daily, especially related to his identity. He's now going through therapy, trauma, and I guess our point of this is that family first isn't a one-size-fit-all. It should be children first, not family.
Thank you so much for taking the time to share your story with us today. Next on the testifiers list, we have, I apologize, Declara Tripp, who will also be joining us via Zoom, will be followed by Stacey Hennen. If you could unmute yourself, Ms. Tripp.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me well?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for allowing me to testify. I'm a mother with lived experience and a professional on the front line working with parents who have had the opportunity to have a positive impact from MAFA CWDA. Witnessing the benefits of such a much needed process has been a blessing. Families are more motivated, open, understanding, and engaging to meet the needs of their children, all while avoiding out-of-home placement, or if placement occurs, staying within their community. This approach, active efforts, has allowed parents to receive support and resources tailored to meet the needs of their children, of their child/children. Providing support while being intentional is a must for our community to thrive successfully. To hear potential risks of interrupting or changing the language to the legislation is heart-wrenching. The MAFA CWDA involved over 7 years of hard work, dedication, and strong advocacy to come to fruition. Moving forward with these changes, with House File 1425, as proposed, will be devastating to the core and protections needed for African-American children and children that are disproportionately represented in child welfare systems. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Joining us at the testifiers table, we have Stacey Hennen, who will be followed by Commissioner Carla Bigham from Washington County. If you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair and members of the committee, I'm Stacey Hennen, the Executive Director of Western Prairie Human Services, consisting of Grant, Traverse, and Pope Counties. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on House File 4125. I'm speaking today from the perspective of County Child Protection Administration in Minnesota. Counties share the legislature's commitment to ensuring that Minnesota's child welfare system operates fairly and equitably, and that all children and families have access to services and supports that promote safety, stability, and well-being. The intent behind House File 4125 to strengthen Minnesota's understanding of racial and other disproportionality in child welfare is important and worthy of thoughtful consideration. Counties recognize that disparities exist in many public systems, including child welfare, and we support efforts that improve transparency, strengthen data analysis, and help identify barriers families face when interacting with public systems. First, counties support the concept of statewide review and analysis of disproportionality. Having the commissioner conduct these reviews may allow for more consistent data analysis and a broader understanding of trends across jurisdiction. This type of statewide analysis can help identify systemic barriers, service gaps, and opportunities for improvement that may not be visible when examining individual counties in isolation. We also support utilizing a statistical or representative sample for each county or entity versus all cases so we can do a full-scale qualitative review of the cases that we review. The purpose of these reviews should be system learning and improvement versus punitive oversight. The goal is to improve our system as a whole and identify areas of strengths and opportunities for improvement. It's important to recognize that county child protection agencies operate within a framework defined by state statutes, court decisions, service availability, and community conditions. Many decisions affecting case outcomes, including permanency, determinations, court orders, and service access, are influenced by factors outside the direct control of the county agency. Second, addressing disproportionality requires more than data analysis. It requires meaningful investment in prevention services, culturally responsive supports, and workforce capacity. Counties frequently encounter families facing complex challenges related to housing instability, untreated mental health needs, substance use disorders, and limited access to community-based services. These conditions often contribute to the very disparities the system is seeking to address. For disparity reduction efforts to succeed, policy expectations must be aligned with adequate and sustainable resources. When legislation contemplates remediation plans or system improvement efforts, counties must have the tools necessary to respond. That includes investments in prevention programming, culturally specific providers, family prevention services, and staffing capacity. Without these supports, counties may be asked to address deeply rooted systemic challenges without the resources needed to produce meaningful change. Third, outcome disparities must be examined within the broader context of community conditions and system structures. Child welfare outcomes are shaped by numerous factors that extend beyond county agency practices.
Ms. Hennen, if you could wrap up your testimony, please.
Yep.
Thank you.
Poverty rates, housing availability, access to treatment services, transportation barriers, and court processes all influence the trajectory of cases and the outcomes. Thank you for your leadership on these issues and for the opportunity to provide input on the legislation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for joining us today. Last testifier who's on the list will be Commissioner and former Senator Carla Bigham. Welcome back to the legislature.
Thank you.
Introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name for the record is Carla Bigham. I'm chair of the Washington County Board of Commissioners and former legislator. I'm here today representing Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Intercounty Association. I also want to give a big shout out to Commissioner Moran and Commissioner Fernando for their county's leadership and their personal leadership in implementing this program as well. All 87 counties from AMC are aligned on AMC's policies here that I'm about to explain. So I'm here today in support of House File 4125 that amends the Minnesota African American Family Preservation and Child Welfare Disproportionality Act. And the counties are routinely expected to make up funding and shortfalls for and filling gaps for service delivery from policies passed at the state and federal level. Counties' cost shifting further exacerbates inequities across our state and the ability to raise property taxes to implement programming or sustain services. Counties want to ensure that implementation of this significant law is not subject to patchwork implementation resulting from inequities in county tax base. To successfully implement MAPPA, it calls for the state investments to be made in the following areas, which is the community-based services and staffing and adjusting the case review function to the state. The state agency is best to conduct the case reviews as it's called for in MAPPA. This is in alignment with existing models such as the CFR-SR and existing federal audit structures, which is important. Counties also support authorizing DCYF to conduct a representative sample of the case reviews as determined by the legislature. Counties want to be strong partners in ensuring the integrity of this important work and working alongside the state to support continuous learning and improvement while strengthening practice in alignment with MAPPA. In addition to case review function, it is imperative that the legislature invest in services and staffing, which you've already heard from Tina and Stacy, so I will fast forward. And successful implementation of MEPMA is at risk if the legislature doesn't make the necessary investments and adjustments included in the bill. So we must make sure that the culturally responsive and prevention services are available to support active efforts and pay close attention to our county-based workforce. And they are critical and necessary component of implementation. And we need to ensure we can attract and retain talented staff, manage caseloads, and prioritize their time being spent with families and not conducting administrative functions. So with that, I will say thank you for your time and thank you to Representative Abaje and Gilman for their work on this important legislation.
Thank you, Commissioner, for joining us today. All right, Commissioner Bigham was the last testifier signed up. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on House File 4125 today? Seeing none, we will move to consider the DE2 amendment from Vice Chair Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Kateza Batun. And I would move the DE2 amendment before the committee. And if you want me to go ahead and explain?
Yes.
Okay. And I thank you for all the work that has been done on this issue. Disproportionality and keeping families together and trying to make life successful for our children and our families. And there's been a lot that's gone into that. And as we look at this, I think we're still waiting on a report from the out of the first, or there's been different areas that we're waiting on. But as we look at what the DE2 would do, one of the things that we want, it's been talked about being successful, and I think there's some areas from the counties that we're hearing on of wanting to be successful and making ensuring that, and part of that would be delaying the implementation of it. This is coming rather quickly. We're less than a year away from that, and the counties are not ready for it. They want to do what is best and do follow what is needed, but it would delay the implementation by a year. It would also expand the active efforts obligation. It would include, you know, families would also be included in being part of this active effort, that the active effort wouldn't solely rest on the counties, but the families would have an active effort in that as well. And I think it's important that to be successful that the families are actively engaged in the efforts that they need as well. The reunification, it would also depend upon the families taking an active effort on that. And the DCYF, disproportionately represented children, that would get changed to in every 3 years. And then would also create a presumption of imminent harm when synthetic opioids are present in a home without a valid prescription. And I think these are, I think they're reasonable things that also would help make this program and this process much more successful. And I would love to see that for the children and for the families, that all of us can be, everyone can be successful in it. And I would ask that we could go ahead and discuss this.
Thank you, Vice Chair Nelson. And I think I forgot to say that you will move the DE2 amendment. Representative Agbaje to the amendment.
Thank you, Chair Kateza Watoon and Co-Chair West, and to members of the committee. After reviewing the DE2 commitment, I'm going to recommend a no vote. While I do appreciate the efforts and considerations of safety and considerations of wanting the family to be involved, active efforts as it is currently defined does take into consideration what the family needs and what the family wants. What it is doing is it directs social service agencies and their workers to work more intensely with families to understand their family situation, to see if it's something that is needing an intervention because of poverty. Maybe they need better housing. Maybe, they need clothes for the children. Whatever it is, they work with the family that is inherent in the active efforts definition. They have to work with the family to make sure that they are addressing those needs that the family has. Active efforts also covers that social service agencies must work with the family to figure out who else is within the circle of kin, whether that's direct family members or community members that have played a strong role in that child's life, to ensure that that child stays with a safe adult should that child need to be placed out of the home. What we've heard from county workers and some of the commissioners who are here today is that people are working with families more intently and more directly now to ensure that their needs are being met. What the language in the DE2 does to me is actually a little bit unclear of now it seems to be putting the onus on the family. Families who have already been impacted in a court system that oftentimes doesn't give them the information and the tools and the resources that they need to keep their families together. The bill also requests a delay, but in my reading of it, I don't see any accountability measures to ensure that the delay will not be indefinite. All I see is a changing of the dates, but there's no reason why. The bill also, interestingly enough, considering that we've heard from multiple counties today asking for resources, does not include any opportunity for additional financial resources for counties or agencies. If folks want to be able to move forward, I believe that HF 4125, as amended by the A4 amendment, is actually the best path forward to make sure that our counties receive the resources that they need, our families are getting the active efforts that they deserve, and that we are working to keep families together and keeping children with safe adults.
Thank you, Representative Egbaje. Member discussion or questions to the DE2 amendment? Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious, Representative Nelson, when you say that, you know, there's a delay, that, you know, we're delaying. I quite frankly, we've heard from testimony today from our commissioners. We've heard from, I mean, and if you need some research, we can talk about it another time. But African Americans have a history of being enslaved and ripped apart from their families. By not moving forward with what we are working on, and thank you, Representative Esther Egbaje, for your hard work on this, and former Representative Commissioner Moran for your hard work, because this is very painful work to navigate through, especially if you are Black women who are mothers. And how much longer do you think we have to work on post 400, 500 years of enslaving Africans and separating children and coming into a space where women of color were not allowed to vote when white women were allowed to vote? And Representative Olson, this isn't news. This is actual American history here. And so, you know, when you're wanting to deteriorate what we've been placed and what facts and data and research has stated, you know, cultural responsiveness and cultural connection. The data shows that it provides social and emotional approaches that are missing from a child's connection. And so, you know, I'm just curious to think why you feel that, you know, this amendment would be justified in improving this program.
Vice Chair Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Katiza Watun and Representative Perez-Vega. I thank you for the question. And we've been hearing from the counties that they are not ready for all of this. And it doesn't apply just to African Americans. It's disproportionality. So it is, whether it's financial or, I mean, there's a fairly long list. So it is not just a racial issue. And our counties are not ready. They want this. They want to be successful in this. And it is not simply just a racial issue.
Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you look at the most marginalized and oppressed communities, it's not a question to see who are receiving a majority of the county services. And so if we're connecting that the counties want to do this, but it's costing the county so much. These are the opportunities to address on how folks don't necessarily maybe have to have more resources that they got to go to the county if we're starting with the child and we're starting with the village. So, you know, I just want to put a standard on, you know, the continuances of what's damaging generational wealth, what's damaging opportunity for housing, what's damaging a child's well-being and nutrition. You know, we've got to make sure that it's connected to the vibrancy. When a child is in a womb, they're listening, they're feeling the environment, they're receiving the nutrition of their culture. And so it's very hard to think that when that child is born, that they're disconnected to that all of a sudden, that they're going to grow okay with being away from that. My grandmother fostered Puerto Rican kids. My aunts fostered Black Puerto Rican kids. It was the differences amongst our cousins by the privilege of what you had. I had more privileges than my Black-skinned cousins who had the same blood rolling at me. These are conversations that we hold on what the disparities are at our own dinner table. And so, like, having a disconnect from folks that are culturally unaware of that, it deteriorates. Having folks wanting to be able to continue their village and be able to get the resources that this state has applicable to those counties to give those resources is what it's asking for. It's the embetterment of, you know, you plant the seed, right? You water it, you want it to grow. But you can't just take a seed in an environment and put it somewhere else where it can't grow and think that a light is going to be able to shine more than your own connection of cultural tribe. And so, yeah, I understand each race has a connectivity to where they're born each, but the reality is that Black people, African-American people in this state and all across the United States of America are at a disparity like no other because of the history of separating, of trying to deteriorate their own lineage and pride. And so I would love to have a conversation with you, Representative Nelson. I'd love to bring you into the circles because I come from a bloodline of 500 years of colonialism where slavery came first before it hit the south of the United States. And we connect with our African diaspora. We connect with the rituals that have survived, that have been around for over 3,000 years. And we see the embodiment of when every child learns about that. That's why ethnic studies is also very important when we talk about these commitments. And I vocalize that as well, because it creates an opportunity for us to learn about how we can make each other's lives better. And right now, our African-American community want to continue to thrive from what has been survived. And it starts with the foundation of a child.
Chair West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On this DE2 amendment, I want to point out it's not just a delay. It has very important improvements, I would say, and I think we have agreement that these are important. I'd love to hear your feedback on it. But on 4.10, it talks about creating a rebuttable presumption when there is a synthetic opioid present, a rebuttable presumption of imminent harm. And I understand the bill itself, or the law itself, said substances, their very presence, can't be used alone, which I understand the goal there, but some substances, synthetic opioids like fentanyl, just their very presence is an imminent harm to the child. And this amendment has a rebuttable presumption to make sure that we treat that differently, because it's like a sack of weed is not fentanyl. You can go through numerous drugs, but fentanyl can kill a kid on contact. It's horrifying. And we heard from the family today with just a horrible story. I
can't imagine having your child taken away. But on 5.1, this amendment allows an adoption to be finalized if it's well underway. And I don't think it's in the best interests of the child to have what happened to that family. I think everyone here would agree to have happen what happened to that family occur for the sake of reunification. This initial bill, when it passed, had broad bipartisan support, but I would say, unfortunately, the legislature did not have broad understanding. We've heard from both sides of the aisle and from many counties that the implementation is really concerning. And, of course, more money is helpful. You hear the counties talk, we would like to get more money to deal with this. And they certainly will need it. But that's one of the reasons why a delay is important. A delay gets us to another budget cycle where more money can be allocated. This is going to prevent a lot of harm because it seems that it's prioritizing parents over the kids. With the Supreme Court...
Please, members of the audience, keep your comments inside your head. Thank you.
The Supreme Court's task force on maltreatment specifically highlighted that in general in our child protection system. So you could have issues with the amendment. We can have a reasoned discussion. But I do want to make sure we're not just focusing on a delay when there's important provisions in here to protect kids from imminent harm, and I think we'd all agree the presence of fentanyl is imminent harm, and it'll prevent that horrible story from happening again. So even if this isn't accepted today, those are important things that need to be included if we're going to make any progress on this.
Representative Hicks.
Chair, oh, if I may respond.
Sorry, Representative Ibaje.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the committee who's brought up some interesting points. I will say that at least on the part of the fentanyl and the opioid use, that is perhaps an acceptable issue in the child protective area, but where it is currently placed in only the MAFPA section of 260C, it actually doesn't make any sense because that's something that should actually apply to every family. If we really consider the use of opioids and fentanyl as a very serious situation, that should apply to every parent that's using fentanyl and not only just MAFPA families. Where it is placed now, that's what it would do. I think you had another section of the DE that you pointed out. Let me just find it. Oh, about removing a child after there's already a permanency placement. Again, the law is not meant to remove children who already have adoptive parents. The purpose is if you already are an adoptive parent, you have custody and rights over your child. And so actually, in fact, if your child qualifies as a MAFPA child, as an adoptive parent, even if you're from a different ethnicity or race or culture of that child would be still within your own circle. And so I feel like that piece doesn't quite hit the mark maybe of what you're trying to say. But as I've noted, we're very open. I'm very open to conversations about this. I'm very open to making sure that parts that people are bringing up about child welfare doesn't all rest on MAFPA, because MAFPA is meant to address a specific harm that was created by the fact that African American families and their children and other disproportionately recognized children were not receiving the same type of care from county officers. Representative Nelson also talked about how this is beyond African American children. It is. And part of that is because that was a request from members across the legislature that wanted to recognize that there are a number of other types of children, not just African-American children, that are also receiving, unfortunately, poor treatment from some of our counties. But we now have seen from the counties who testified today that there are so many who want to right that wrong and do that work. And in order to do that work, what they have asked for is not a delay, but they have asked for additional resources. And what my bill, as amended, does
is provide a pathway for those additional resources while also addressing some of the concerns that they've specifically brought up in the statewide working group as well as other arenas. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I have a question, I think, probably for Representative Nelson. So I'm absolutely, like, fentanyl bad. Shouldn't let the children touch the fentanyl. Very, very bad. However, the way this is written, I'm a little concerned about emergency removals because fentanyl is present. How does this work if the teenager is the person who brought in the fentanyl?
Vice Chair Nelson.
Thank you. I'm not quite sure how to answer that, but I think with, you know, if a teenager is the one that is, you know, assuming they're the ones that is the foster or the child, I'm not sure. Not sure where to go with that. I hate to just spring it on
nonpartisan,
but you know, I think it there's
we can go to House Research. That's okay. Ms. Sunderman, can you illuminate us on whether or not this is considered in the bill?
Madam Chair and members, as drafted, it's just if it's present in the home. It doesn't specify who is controlling the synthetic opioid or who obtained the synthetic opioid. So it's just the presence in the home.
Probably. It's a great question, Representative Hicks.
Yeah. So when I read this, this is why this is really concerning for me, because, again, only one who's fostered teenagers. The way this is written, it wouldn't matter if it was the parent. It wouldn't matter if it was the teenager, the child themselves, right, a teenager. It wouldn't matter if it was an uncle. It wouldn't matter if it was a sibling. The way this is written, you would be removing children from a home because someone in the family has an addiction. And fentanyl access for itty-bitties and tinies is not the same thing as a teenager with addiction. And this, the way it is written, would say you're going to remove all the kids in a home because a teenager has a fentanyl addiction. That is incredibly concerning to me, because it wouldn't even have to be a foster kid. It could be just a teenager who has fallen into addiction, and there is fentanyl found in the home, and now all of the siblings in that whole house have to be put into foster care because their sibling has an addiction. That is not okay for me. So I want to point that out. When we're talking about child welfare laws and we're talking about emergency removal, we have to think deeply about unintended consequences, because they are big and they are huge when we talk removal, because the trauma of an emergency removal never goes away, and we should not be doing it in any way that is not completely lock tight.
Vice Chair Nelson, any follow-up?
Thank you for that, and that's a fair point, and I appreciate the concern there, and I definitely understand that, and I'd be happy to continue to work on this with you.
Representative Sensumura.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is actually to speak to the point that Representative Abaje raised about why would this just be in MAPPA. So we actually did, I think, pass something that addresses this last year. People remember Representative Knudsen's bill that was, you know, passed by this committee with bipartisan support. So, I mean, I guess I would say, you know, Representative Nelson, I think it would make sense to look in that statute 152.137, which is a lot longer than this and includes a section about, you know, when you can take a child out because they're in the presence of someone using one of these substances. So I agree with the author. I don't really understand why this would just be in the MAFPA statute. And I think we actually did some really good work around this that, as I'm reading it, I feel like really covers everything and doesn't just apply to these parents, but just says, yeah, there's great concerns if a child is in a house where people are using fentanyl. So, thank you.
Representative Perez, briefly.
Yeah, Madam Chair, you know, I kept hearing that you said, Representative Nelson, that there is a delay, that the counties are asking for a delay. I heard from three counties today, and not one of their commissioners stated that they wanted this to be delayed. So I'd be curious if you'd like to, you know, point the arrow to which counties those are, and I'd love to have a conversation with them in particular this session. Thanks.
Perhaps that's something that we can take offline. Representative Egbaje, any final comments on the DE2?
Only just, you know, I'm happy to keep workshopping with people on 4125 with, you know, through my amendment and any other future amendments. I just do not believe this D2 amendment does that job. So I would recommend a no vote.
And Vice Chair Nelson, closing comments to your amendment.
Thank you, Chair Katiza-Watoon, and thank you for your commitment to continue working on this. I think this is a very important issue. And, you know, we've heard from counties that they want additional resources. They need additional resources. And I think we see that there's some counties that are getting them. And there are 85 other counties that are kind of left out. And to have a successful program, to have a successful implementation, the counties are asking or have asked for a delay, and they've asked for additional resources, and this is part of that. And so I would ask for a yes vote today.
All right. Members, Vice Chair Nelson renews his motion to move the DE2 amendment. All those in favor of the DE2, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Nay. The motion fails, and the DE2 is not adopted.
Do you want me to say anything or just member discussion?
You can go right ahead, Representative Agbaje,
I would just say that, thank you so much for the conversations we've had. I know that there is a lot of interest in the MAFBA law. You know, the focus of this bill, as amended by the A4, is really just meant to provide some clarity where counties and the working group have asked for it. It's also meant to, give us an opportunity to discuss what those resources would look like, so that way implementation can go on smoothly. I know that there's still conversations to be had. There's a couple committee stops for this, so I'm hopeful that as people have ideas that they continue to come to me with them, and we'll see how we can work together. So with that, happy to take questions from members as you would like, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. I don't have any members on the list, so sorry. Okay. Yeah. Representative Perez.
I have a question just because it came up in this bill, Madam Chair, for you. Have we ever had any adjustment of the rules for any other bill in regards to rules in committee?
Representative
While Perez, we've been in this session?
Representative Perez, yes. Both Chair West and I have been trying to remember to start off the committee hearings with those rules, and it was not something that I remembered to do at the start of this afternoon's
Till
hearing.
Today.
No, we've said it multiple times before.
Okay.
At the start of the hearing, and it's something that I forgot to do at the start of the hearing. So I wanted to do it when I remembered to do so.
All right, thank you.
Yep. Representative Hicks.
This is more of a comment than a question, but I would love to chat about the definition of disability, and the language that's here is fine. But DCYF does have a person who's supposed to be doing the interagency work around disability, because disability impacts multiple components of a person's life, whether they be a child or an adult. And so I just want to make sure we don't mess it up. If we could chat a little bit about maybe put some parameters around that, I'd really appreciate it.
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hiss. Yes, that is definitely something we want to talk about. I know Senator Hoffman in the Senate is also very interested in how that definition gets determined by the agency, so I imagine there will be more conversations as this bill moves forward.
Representative Hansen. Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Agbaje. I appreciate this, and I just want to acknowledge how much work goes into threading this needle. This is really deep and serious work, and I think your amendment reflects how seriously you're taking this. I think you've thought really thoroughly about a lot of pieces of it. Your comments about, where in statute do some of the issues that arise in this conversation belong, I think are exactly on point. And I hope it raises this committee's attention to how much work goes into this broad system in general, that it is not just because of the bill before us that we have work to do. I've been my entire career here spent talking about that our system looks far too much like boarding schools and has for a long time. And we have been undoing that as a body together, and we should be proud of that. But we have to continue to do the deep work and really understanding the implications of everything we do and say. And I think What we see in the DE2 amendment, and this is not personal, but I just wanted to, like, on the records recognize this, that there are some things that I was looking at that, like, glaringly tell me we have to talk about this more together. And I think some of the comments I heard today reflect that as well. So I hope this can be a lesson for all of us to take away and hear ourselves when we talk about things that we want to change, or when we propose amendments, or when we put forward an idea that hasn't really kind of been maybe fully fleshed out yet, and be open to that and have that humility, frankly. I get that it's complicated. I'm the first one to say that. And I'm really impressed by how well you do this and how many stakeholders come to the table again and again and again to keep making sure we're getting this right. So I just wanted to give you some kudos and recognition for that, because this is not easy work in this lane, and I love having you in this work with me. So thank you for everything.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative, for this presentation. My question, or more of a just a something to think about, is I have heard from the counties that I represent, and from many in northern Minnesota, that they're not concerned. The idea is one part, and so complying with it, everybody wants to do that. What's concerning is an idea without funding. And what's also concerning is we have a lot of conversations, including the governor's initiative, which we all have been talking about, with the IT issues that have faced the county since the late 1980s and early 1990s. And in this committee last year, we passed money for the SSIS system, but that hasn't even started yet. So it feels like we are putting the cart before the horse. It feels like we have the idea, and everybody agrees with that, but only two counties were funded. The counties that are in this area, there isn't funding, and that is the piece, that's the gap. I mean, that is the real gap. And if we're talking $2 million for a county, if we're talking $1 million for a county, the people back home are saying, well, wait a minute, if the levy amounts change and we have mandates coming from this body to the local entities, and in this case it would be the county, that's just one piece of the triangle that formulates property taxes too, which then further increases concerns for people back home. So I support what you're doing, and to support kids. I just want to make sure the mechanism of support is there with the funding in a solid way, and that the IT systems are able to catch up so that all of this can be done in the way that you're intended. And I hope that you'll seriously consider it. So I don't see it as a delay in the sense of just kicking the can. I see it as get the pieces in place with the funding and the IT systems so that it can be successful. And I hope you will consider that. Thank you.
Representative Igbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Zalesnikar, for those comments. I mean, I agree with you. Yes, SSIS needs to be funded. We put out that funding as a legislative body last year. We have had, and in fact, we do want to know what they're doing with that money. I sit on the Ways and Means Committee. We had a full committee hearing with the Minnesota IT. We heard from DHS, and we also heard from counties. This is a very serious issue. But what I will say, as you commented, this was a system that was developed in 1989, and this legislative body, through all of its iterations, decided not to invest in it until we started investing in it in, what was it, 22 or 23 or 24, somewhere around there. So it's going to take time for that funding to flow through that system. In the meantime, that system still has to do the work that we require it to do, whether that's through SNAP funding, Medicare, Medicaid, Child Protection Services, all of that. We can't stop our work just because we have a computer system that takes time. And I fully empathize with those workers. We saw the presentation. That's not a great system to work with. But what I hope is that those departments that are in charge of that funding, which I think is like almost close to $100 million, if not more, that they start to use that funding in a way to make sure that our workers do not have to spend that time in front of a screen and they can actually do the job that they're meant to do. So I agree with you on that. I will keep working and pushing along with other members of this body that DHS does that work to update its systems with the funding that we've given it. And then, and that's just all I'll say on that. And then, you know, I believe that
the state of Minnesota can walk and chew gum at the same time. And so we have to be able to do what is mandated of us. And as it relates to the funding, we have an appropriation in this bill. It's a blank appropriation, but that's because we know we don't quite know exactly where our budgets are going to be. We don't know what our targets are going to be. We want to be able to go in with the full power of negotiation to say, this is what the counties need, this is what the counties want, and then understanding what that budget forecast, what that budget system is going to look like, so we can get the most dollars that can go the furthest for our counties. I don't want to see counties have to increase property taxes either, but we know that for those who are already doing this, like you heard from Meeker County, they know how to do this, they've been able to do this. What they require is some additional resources, and that's what I plan to fight for in the rest of this legislative session.
Thank you, Representative Egbaje. I think it is important to note that this is not your intention in any sense of the word, because this is existing law that we, most of us, voted for. So I just want to address that there. I have got Representative Sensimura, followed by Vice Chair Nelson, Chair West, Representative Egbaje with final comments, and then we will go to a vote. Representative Sensimura.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Egbaje, for this bill. This is a bill that is working to build off of what was already passed, which is undoing centuries of systemic racism, and so it's not easy work. So thank you for leading. I just wanted to say thank you to Meeker County for coming out and testifying. I thought that testimony was really powerful. I think oftentimes we think that this work is only happening in the metro counties, and so it's really helpful to hear support from a county in greater Minnesota. And I think what I really took away from that was just if you're really going to do this work right, like how robust it needs to be. It really is this whole family approach, which is not easier and I think can often require more resources. And I appreciated just the note that they made about how HR1 is going to complicate and, you know, potentially destroy the systems that we are trying to build to support families and move this work forward. So it's really scary, and we as a state are just constantly being asked to step in to the gap that the federal government is creating, and this is another one of those places. But I appreciate your leadership. I appreciate you for continuing to advocate for counties to have the funding they need to do to be able to do this right by our kids. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sensimura. Vice Chair Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Katiza Watoon. And, you know, we've heard from a lot of people today. We've heard from individuals, families, commissioners, from counties. And I'm just wondering, you know, and I think Representative Sensimura, thank you for bringing up, you know, the complications HR1 is kind of adding to this. And I'm wondering if we could hear from DCYF. Is there, you know, has there been, how is it going with training? How is it going with, I mean, I know technology is a part of it, and we're kind of waiting on that, and that isn't something you can just flip the switch on, but I'm wondering if there's, you know, how is it going on that side of things? Are we moving along with the training? Because we are seeing the shift in our counties is moving towards an active effort. It is moving that way, and it should be. But I think one of the things that we're hearing from our counties, or at least I am, is the concern that it's January 1st is an on switch and everything is turning to an active effort, and just the concern there. So
we do have Assistant Commissioner St. George coming up to the testifiers table. We are already over time, so Assistant Commissioner, if you could address very briefly. Otherwise, we can certainly ask the department to follow up offline with the committee members.
Sure, thank you.
If you could introduce yourself for the record.
Sure, I'm Rebecca St. George. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Child Safety and Permanency with DCYF. And at this point, our staff is working on the guidance and training that we need to be in online to be ready for implementation under the current timeline.
Thank you. And we would certainly love any additional feedback that the department can provide for us, perhaps in email form or maybe even in committee next week. Sure. Thank you for sharing.
Yep.
Chair West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know you and Representative Gilman have been working together very intensely. I've heard a lot about it, trying to come to an agreement that actually can help resolve some of these issues. I don't think this bill gets us anywhere even close. Taking on 20% of the cases, those might not even be the cases of the counties that truly need the help. We're talking like counties that have staff of 5, 10, 15 people compared to the two counties that got money that have massive staffs. So I don't think this case review, yes, will help in the long term, but it needs to help for the counties that need it, not just a unparametered 20%. And if it's too much for DSIF to take on all this casework, imagine how much it is for these tiny counties. This doesn't go anywhere to fixing it, and the counties have been crying out for a delay, not an indefinite delay. I know Representative Gbaje has been very serious about, we don't just want a delay for no reason, we want a delay with meat to it, which is what Representative Gilman was trying to get us to, and that it was our DE2 amendment. It contained very important things. I don't need to go on about them. And that would actually help this bill, well, this existing law, benefit everyone because it'll actually function. It'll give the work group time to help counties move us down the field and get something working. But just this bill, a little bit of money, sure, counties get excited about getting a little bit of money all the time. It's just not going to do it. And I wish we would take the bipartisan work that Representative Gilman and you've worked on and find a route that can meaningfully make this law work well and the way it was intended. Because we have heard repeatedly since it became law, even though it had massive bipartisan support, there were many issues that we did not foresee as the legislature. So with that, I would urge members not to support the bill.
Representative Egbaje, final closing comments.
All right. Well, thank you, Chair and members. MAFA has been working in Hennepin and Ramsey, and they've been sharing their data and what's been happening through the statewide work group. Statewide work group has been open to counties. I know many counties have gone there and actually even presented their own work. If you read the current statute, it's open for counties, big and small, to start their own program, to start advancing active efforts, as we heard from Meeker County today. One of the things I also want to lift up from Meeker County is, like, this law is actually about the children. It's about ensuring that their own fundamental rights are preserved. And the bill before us gives an opportunity to continue to do that. I will just say that laws like MAFA, similar to other large laws that we've passed in the legislature over the years, they're an iterative process. I imagine there's still some laws that were passed in the 1990s and 2000s that we're still tinkering with as we try to figure out how to make it better. And so we learn from that implementation. And this bill addresses the immediate needs from those who have been actually working on the ground with this since 2024 when it went into effect for the phase-in program. We see that more families are united, they are able to stay together, and it leads to better outcomes throughout the system. So this is all in order to, I am also supportive of prevention efforts that people are doing across the board, and I think all of that works in together to ensure that families who are overrepresented in our system continue to get the care and resources that they need from our government so that way they can keep healthy families together. So with that, Madam Chair, I request the support from the committee to move this bill to its next committee stop.
Thank you, Representative Egbaje. Members, I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 4125 as amended to the Committee on Judiciary and Civil Law. All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Any opposed?
Nay.
All right.
No.
The motion prevails.
Division, and Madam Chair. Absolutely we can.
Right.
There was not a single Republican that voted for that bill.
Okay. Members, everyone who voted aye, please raise your hand. Okay. And everyone who voted nay, please raise your hand. Okay, four. All right. The count was 7 ayes and 4 nays. The motion does not prevail, and the House File 4125, as amended, will stay with us here in Children and Families. Sure, Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make a comment about that. I think yesterday we had a conversation about child protection, about protecting all kids, and I just want to highlight that this bill is just trying to move its way through the process. It's taken into consideration lots of member feedback. We have counties who are saying that this is there. I don't see a county letter in here that says to oppose it, to stop it. I stand with my counties that have asked us to support this. I stand with the bill author, and I just want it on the record that if we are really serious about protecting all kids, this is a way to do it. And I'm very confused as to why that just happened. So thank you, Chair.
I would agree. Members, we are adjourned. Mm-hmm.